Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Brian Armstrong. Brian is the Managing Director with Ensemble Innovation Ventures. Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Christian. A pleasure to be with you today.
Well, really looking forward to this. I know we've had an opportunity to meet, last year, Rocky Mountain Venture Capital Association. Yep. Fellow mountain lover of all things, and so love to dive into it with Ensemble. What's
the firm's
investment thesis, and what's your role inside?
Sure. Ensemble Innovation Ventures is a health tech and tech-enabled services venture fund. We focus exclusively on software and services into the healthcare realm. So solutions that optimize both point of care and back office for payers, providers, or really any commercial healthcare stakeholder. So including pharma, looking for technology solutions just to further enable their day-to-day. We have a number of white spaces that we focus on, and no surprise, the advent of AI, particularly as it's brought to bear in healthcare, is a real specific focus for us near term, although we look at data and analytics and a number of other white spaces. We typically focus on Series A rounds. That's kind of our sweet spot. So about 75% of our first checks go into A rounds, and about 25% of our checks go into seed rounds. We do like to, for the A rounds, we do like to see companies that are, doing $1.5 million to $2 million of annualized run rate at a minimum and up from there. And then for our seed stage investments, we love to see companies that are post-revenue, but early revenue, maybe even past proof of concept and onboarding their first 10 customers, 5 to 10 customers, and running at about $750K to $1.5 million at run rate. We love syndicates. And so we're just based on our profile, it's really important for us to co-invest with super strong syndicates with a very strong lead, as we don't lead. And so it's really, I find it, frankly, a joy of my profession to interact and cultivate relationships, not just with founders who are innovating super cool solutions, but like-minded investors. So I have fun on both sides of the equation.
Fantastic. So we were talking before, a bit unique. There's one limited partner. Is Ensemble considered a corporate venture capital?
I would sort of call it a hybrid. We are a separate legal entity. We have a captive and dedicated pool of capital. We've structured Ensemble very much like a traditional venture fund with an LP agreement with a single limited partner. So the guardrails and the governance very much mirror a traditional venture fund. We found that to be critically important. I would say that really any full corporate venture fund or hybrid corporate venture fund needs to know what its dedicated capital is, just like a traditional venture fund. It's just important because as you're deploying dry powder, you want to know what the full fund capability is, and over what period of time. So we've really outlined this in a very traditional manner.
And so then, is the investment focus on financial or strategic returns?
It's a really interesting question. We debated when we conceptualized this fund back in 2019, we had long conversations, healthy conversations about what made the most sense and what specific sort of niche we could fill, both with our thesis and with our capital. And ultimately, we decided that we wanted to really focus on three outcomes: financial returns, impact on healthcare, and I can come back to that and be more specific about what we mean by impact on healthcare, and then strategic back to the operating company of our limited partner. And that, I would say, of the three, we try to be very open-minded in every single investment opportunity that we're evaluating. We don't have to hit on all, it's not like we're looking for strategic impact and financial together on all three. So we're very flexible, but financial obviously is foundational. We won't be doing this if we're not generating financial returns. So that is kind of ante in the game, so to speak. And then to the degree that we're looking at some really compelling impact in healthcare and or a very interesting strategic intersection with our operating company, that's fantastic. But again, we don't have to find all three in every single case.
I'm curious, has it made or has it created any unique challenges for sourcing deal flow?
It's interesting. That was the concern when we conceptualized this and when we had the healthy conversations about how we set this up and what our objectives should be. And because we were a little concerned about how the potential of this strategy could narrow the field for us, we were very much in lockstep around creating a lot of flexibility such that we would not need to see all three attributes concurrently. So we, on any number of deals that we've invested in, certainly the financial return need is there for every single investment opportunity. But I would say that beyond that, healthcare impact is largely the second most important attribute, because if we're a healthcare fund, we're a health tech fund and tech-enabled services. So if we can't see some kind of favorable impact on healthcare, I'm not sure why we would even want to be doing what we're doing, right? That's part of why we're here, is to be able to walk away and say we've played some small role in generating favorable impact on healthcare. And that itself is along three core tenets as well: access to care, cost of care, and outcomes of care. So that's really important, fundamentally important to us. And then I would say third, the one that is probably the most opportunistic is strategic. And by the way, most corporate venture funds of our profile and size would probably say the same, which is you can't support every single portfolio company in some kind of deep strategic way, because you'd be a mile wide and an inch deep, and you would really overburden and overtax your operating company partners, who are really the ones ultimately who are trying to help execute and fulfill against some kind of strategic potential. So we're very mindful of making sure that if we're going to ask for time and talent on the operating company side, that we're not doing it in such a way that that becomes a disproportionate core focus of some of our operating company partners, because ultimately they're there to do something different, right? So it's great if we can find those opportunities to work with our partners on the operating company side, but we don't want to take it too much advantage of that, because it does become the potential is it could become disproportionate.
So building on that, how would you break down sources for deal flow? Is it a lot of inbound, a lot of co-investor network?
It's all of those, and so let me just I'll dig in a little bit on this. We are really intentional about outbound deal sourcing. The outbound tends to be more about cultivating a pipeline that can mature over time. So we do, like many venture funds, we do like to meet founders very early, knowing full well that they're too early for us potentially at the moment that we meet them. But if we cultivate a really strong relationship and we can get to know the team and the solution over a period of time, through formal and informal observation and checkpoints, we're just much more confident that by the time that company would fit into our zone, that we're going to make an informed decision through diligence and just through context. So outbound is largely skewed towards cultivating a longer-term pipeline. Inbound is really by virtue of cultivating relationships with co-investors. And in fact, we have a saying, a mantra, if you will, at Ensemble, which is that who we co-invest with is every bit as important as who we invest in. So we're very, very intentional about cultivating authentic relationships with potential syndicate partners. And in healthcare, no surprise, it's pretty clear over a period of time of cultivating these relationships what that population set is around healthcare investors, like-minded healthcare investors. So we kind of get to a point where when we're at a foundational level of relationships in the healthcare investing space, it's from that point forward, it's really much easier to just continue cultivating and strengthening those relationships. So we're not really starting from scratch the way that we might if we were industry agnostic investors or technology solution agnostic investors. We're more focused and more targeted, which comes with obviously pros and cons. But one of the advantages is that, you know, once we've identified that population of healthcare, like-minded health tech investors, it's really easy to continue to sort of cultivate those relationships because the population is very defined.
And are you guys focused on Mountain West, or are you
all over the country? I sort of have this philosophy that if we're serious about having favorable impact on healthcare, we have to be willing to invest in any location in the United States where there's a very compelling solution to do just that. And, you know, I think what we've learned is that health tech does try to exploit existing relationships. These founders try to exploit existing relationships in their own healthcare networks, which can start out regionally. And that is often what it takes to get to a very compelling proof of concept. And so, you know, in health tech, there's a little bit of that transition from kind of a near-term regional prospecting focus on the founder side for selling their solution into the industry, from that point going to a much broader prospecting and pipeline. So the byproduct of that is that when we're investing, particularly in seed stage companies, often they're still selling regionally, and that means that we're investing. We are very open to investing wherever those solutions exist, even if they're regional for a very brief period of time as they're proving and commercializing the solution. So it does care. We've got investments in New England, upper Midwest, lower Midwest, Pacific Northwest, Southwest, Rocky Mountain region. I think the only place where, you know, we haven't yet found the opportunity that makes sense for us is Southeast. But the day will come. The day will come.
Interesting. Anything unique about the Southeast?
I think it's where we've probably had the longest time to cultivate authentic relationships with syndicate partners. Most, like, if for example, you find a lot of health tech investors in the Mid-Atlantic. You find them in Boston. You find them in upper Midwest. You find them in Pacific Northwest. So there, and obviously Southwest too. So there are some hot spots of energy around health tech and across the country. And that does have a large correlation to where some of those institutional investors reside as well. And so that's kind of, we just started with where the lowest hanging fruit was, both in terms of pipeline on investment opportunities, as well as relationships that we could cultivate on the investment, on the co-investment side. And we're finally starting to see signs of some real hard work to make sure that that's also the case in the Southeast.
Fantastic. You know, you mentioned facets of healthcare like access and outcomes on, you know, and so as I think about it, there's a lot of expertise that needs to be maintained to be successful in investing in healthcare. How's Ensemble subsequently structured the team to be able to not only, you know, check all the boxes or do all the work that's associated with running a venture capital fund, but also staying abreast of the industry's developments?
Yeah, it's really, that's a great question. And we know that just given the size of our team, we can't rely exclusively on our full team, if you will, to to self-actualize on the platform. So we lean very heavily on our advisory group. We have a dedicated advisory group for Ensemble Innovation Ventures, comprised of people that we know and have known, who have healthcare expertise and who can be an extension of our eyes and ears in the industry. And then we also have a, I should probably press rewind a little bit and clarify that we have a holding company that we created in part to establish this vehicle so that it would not be, it would be much easier for us to navigate as kind of a hybrid corporate venture fund. And that holding company has its own board in addition to the operating company having a separate board. So we rely on the Holdco board quite a bit too, to be an extension of our eyes and ears. And I'll tell you, it's been great because some of those individuals are running into investment opportunities or relationships that I had not, or anyone on my team had not, by the point that we got that introduction. And some of them have made a real difference. They've culminated in a number of ways. So we are very intentional, again, about relying on and taking advantage of this kind of neural network that comes from our advisory group and our Holdco board. And then inside of our team, I have a co-managing director, Helen Drexler, and then I have a principal, an associate principal, Shannon Flahive, and then we have two associates. So we're, you know, just in terms of all of the blocking and tackling that goes on in a inside of a venture fund on a day-to-day basis, we're really well situated. And then of course we, you know, I feel really good about our pipeline of investment opportunities that end up, you know, really on the list, and then we kind of move them through various stages, shallow dive, deep dive, and observation. As I mentioned before, some of those really early deals we just kind of want on our radar so we can observe over time and get to learn more and more about the founders and the solutions in a kind of a natural progression of the calendar.
And what fund are you guys on now?
Fund one.
Fund one.
We'll start contemplating. We'll be fully identified as a fund probably by early 28. So we're already kind of putting pen to paper on alternative approaches for a fund two. And I don't think we'll be out there, you know, executing against those that plan until late 2027, early 2028.
Got it. And would you characterize the fund as concentrated, or is, are the bets more broad?
I guess the way I would characterize it is when we established this fund, our target was 18 to 22 companies, and we are very diversified. We take a pretty strong diversification approach in this fund. So of the number, we've invested in 13 companies against that target of 18 to 22. And so you can sort of get the, you know, you can infer the pace on an annual basis. We're doing 2 to 4 deals a year. But we are very diversified inside the existing portfolio, and we will remain very diversified as we round out the last third of this fund. So we will not be concentrated in similar or adjacent solutions. We won't be concentrated in the customers that these solutions sell into. We want diversification on that front as well. And we won't be concentrated necessarily or overly so in our syndicate compositions. We like diversification there also. So we take just kind of this, you know, this broad diversification objective into our, you know, really into our pipeline and into our investment decisions.
Got it. What does your day to day look like? And then if you can also comment on division of responsibilities between yourself and the co-managing director. I think you said her name was Helen.
Yes. So no day is predictable. I mean, you know that, and anyone who's working in venture, your calendar might say one thing when you get into the office in the morning, and then the way the day plays out is typically very different. And so, but I will just give you kind of the foundational structure of my day. I am very mindful of how, this is a little bit of an insight to my personality, but I'm very mindful of how distracting it can be to just stay at the desktop level in venture. It's very, I mean, let's face it, we're anyone who's doing this, we're engaging with a lot of third parties just by definition. So founders, co-investors, service providers, advisors, we're in touch with so many people every day. And some of that's via email or digital interaction. And some of it's live, whether it's Zoom or phone or in person. And so I try to compartmentalize my day such that when I start, I'm really carving out the first 90 minutes just to kind of get into email and make sure I'm current. And then I really try hard not to look at email for the whole rest of the day until I get to maybe my last 45 minutes of the day before I'm ready to put my pencil down. So I'm effectively bookending my day with the digital interaction. And I try to preserve the rest of the day for just my desktop level work and all of my in-person or virtual interaction. And that includes spending time with, whether it's across the table from or in a Zoom meeting with our founders that we've supported and invested in, our partners on the operating company side with whom we really rely heavily on fulfilling that strategic potential for the subset of companies where there is a strategic intersection with the operating company, and then co-investors, and I'm a firm believer that in venture, the devil is in the detail, and the detail largely is both by virtue of interacting live with key stakeholders on any kind of topic that you're trying to dig into, as well as the desktop, just the carving out the desktop time, right? That's detail. That's the detail too. And I don't find that tedious at all. I know that sometimes people in venture, they skew more heavily towards one side or the other, very understandably, but I enjoy both. I like a balance. I want to spend part of my day at my desk, digging in, whether it's overseeing diligence, specific tasks and diligence that we're in the middle of, and or even lending a hand in diligence, right? I mean, I think every managing director, every partner, that's how we stay fresh, is if we're actually executing some of those diligence steps with our teams. And it enables us to gain keener insights as to the investment opportunity. And then, I'm just interacting with our advisors and our board and our co-investors and our founders and any service providers that are bringing unique services and support to one of our portfolio companies or whom we think might be in a position to do that for a company that where we're evaluating that. So a lot of phone interaction, a lot of Zoom interaction, a lot of across the table interaction, and then try to carve out desktop time for both email and just my day-to-day work.
As I think about venture in general, I kind of think of it as a very analog business. There's a lot of tasks that need to take place, many of which are time consuming.
Yeah.
But I've also been fascinated by, what I see as a transition towards a data-driven venture models. Curious, would love to know, what steps, if any, the firm has started to take internally.
Yeah.
Start to leverage AI for its own internal processes.
Yeah. It's interesting because we started this conversation internally about a year ago, and we tried to identify any low-hanging fruit opportunity for us to bring AI to bear in our own kind of inside the four walls, so to speak. So there are a number of ways that we're able to do that now. And let's face it, we're just probably scratching the surface as an industry. I think in 5 years, much of what venture does on a day-to-day basis will be even further enabled and could be game-changing enabled by AI solutions that make sense for us to use. But no surprises probably for you in terms of how we're using it today. We love how AI can transcribe our meetings and then identify specific nuggets in a conversation that we've either committed to following up on or empirically require us to follow up on, as well as some opportunities in the conversation that have emerged that that's sort of the keen insight. So we're doing quite a bit with that. We're also managing our pipeline and our interactions and, just kind of codifying and making sure that all of our interactions are essentially included in our database of pipeline interaction. And then we, I think that the next stage for us, and we're really in the middle of identifying this, is how we can use AI in diligence. So we're how AI can enable us to move through diligence more comprehensively and on a more accelerated basis without giving up any of our core tenets of diligence, right? We don't want to, we're not going to compromise that. But what are the ways in which we can bring to bear AI so that our team doesn't have to grow, but could actually move more opportunities through the pipe, so to speak, is just another way. And then frankly, the last kind of, and this is going to be a little more nuanced because we've all got success stories, but also complaints about using tools to help us identify comps and analysis for both in the diligence process, but also in our existing portfolio, how we compare and contrast our investments to an ever-changing landscape of competitors and market dynamics. And what's the synthesis of that information that we can use to be smarter and more informed about how to, how to more effectively think strategically about our own portfolio.
If we, I would love to know if we can zoom out for a moment. How did you get into venture?
Well, it's interesting. I, back in 99, I was working for a company that created what at that point didn't have a name, but which today would be sort of identified as either an in-house studio or an incubator. So what we did, that we were a technology services company, and we invited really interesting founders who were very early, so not, not generating revenue and really still trying to prototype their solutions. We invited them and their small teams into our space. And we created in different parts of the country in different offices that we had, different labs, so to speak, that again today we would call studios. And we would take founders' equity for helping these companies get to a point where they had a product that they could take to market and then hopefully commercialize successfully. And again, we didn't, I don't even think we had a name for this. I think we just, we started to experiment with it because we were seeing such interesting innovation. So we would bring development support, tech development support, we'd bring UX support, we'd bring market strategy support and go to market, kind of road mapping and playbooking support to these companies, and then really just serve as advisors to founders who were obviously navigating all sorts of interesting times in the late 90s. And that was my first foray into kind of this asset class. And I really loved it. I loved the energy of founders. I love the energy of innovation, but also kind of founders who own these innovations, because that's where the real passion and the magic starts to emerge. And it doesn't work every time, as we know, but I do love that energy. And so fast forward to 2010, I was in a position at that point in my career to actually contemplate really getting involved in dedicated deployment of capital, like dry powder, not just taking founders' equity for work that we were doing. And in the interim, by the way, I had left that experience and was the CFO of a company. So I was out of the tech services world for just a few years, and then I got back into it by virtue of this venture platform in my previous fund, and joined a bunch of great partners and deployed dry powder into tech industry agnostic technology solutions, again, across the country. and reestablish this passion for this asset class, and really have, I've just, you know, I continue to love it. And I think it's important, right? I think it's important work. I think there's some mission and purpose to what we do in the venture profession. We are trying to accelerate innovation. We are trying to catalyze growth. We are trying to solve really pressing problems and take advantage of really compelling and provocative opportunities. And we're very fortunate in the ecosystem that exists in, you know, in the United States to get behind this asset class and to get behind innovation and to get behind founders who are working on hard problems. So that's how I, so once, you know, once I got back into this in 2010, I just realized this is something that I will do for the remainder of my career. And that's exactly what's happened.
Awesome. Well, now you've got, seems like what, quarter of a century under your belt.
Hard to imagine, but yeah.
So, you know, love to get your perspective on where you see venture today. You know, and I'll throw out, you know, my observations around coming off of frothy valuations at the turn of the decade. Now we're higher interest rate environment, as we talked about AI. Where do you see, what's your take today and where do you see the industry headed?
Yeah, this is, I've either been involved in venture or I've been a very keen observer of venture, really since the late 90s. And I would submit to you that this is probably the most unpredictable era, kind of longer term era in venture that I've seen. And by unpredictable, I mean there is so much happening with technology that's going to impact the way we do our work in venture. And there's also uncertainty geopolitically and economically that has created some illiquidity, some additional, relatively speaking, additional illiquidity in the venture asset class. And so, and I think the other thing we've seen is a lot of established funds have announced that they are not going to raise a next fund. And so we have a lot of these mature platforms who are going to kind of wind down over time as they drive liquidity for the remainder of their portfolios. And then on the other side of that, we have all of these emerging funds that are smaller, relatively smaller than these more mature established funds. So we have the N is greater in terms of the number of funds that are smaller and the way in which they can have impact in these syndicated investments has really been interesting for me to watch because it's been the case really for the last 5 years. We also had this unbelievable, you know, event of COVID in terms of the way that impacted the venture asset class. So everybody fell off the cliff with deal flow, and then everybody got to the top of Everest on deal flow and valuations, by the way, in the space of like 12 months. And then it started to kind of get back to a more normal cadence until inflation and interest rates started to increase. And we saw a lot of the geopolitical uncertainty in healthcare specifically. What we're observing is quite a bit of policy change and even policy whiplash might be a better way to put it. And so it's incumbent upon us to really understand what these policy and legislative changes are going to do in terms of either accelerating or redirecting innovation. I'm a firm believer that there's always innovation. It's either just redirected or it's accelerated or it's a little bit slower, a little bit faster, what have you. But innovation will, it's like water finds a gap, right? Innovation will emerge. It just always will. And so there's never a time in venture that I think is a bad time to invest. It's just you have to change the way you think about and evaluate and get informed on investment opportunities that changes. And so that's why we like the work that we do, because it's never static. But I think in 5 years, venture is going to The next 5 year period, if we just looked at the history of venture, the next 5 years are going to change venture more than any 5 year period in the history of venture. That's what I believe. And I can't even begin to make the predictions at a detailed level of how different it's going to be. But I just inherently know it will be very, very different because of the changes in the ingredients that I just laid out, whether it's fund size, fund maturity, the number of funds, the, you know, kind of unwinding from high inflation and high interest rates, the advent of AI and what that means to a fund and how it does the work that it does. Ever changing. And so these next 5 years, I think we'll see a much larger clip of change than we've seen in any other 5 year period since venture became an asset class that was institutional, so to speak.
And so, Brian, I love it. It'll be interesting. Yeah, I agree. It's going to be uber fascinating to see how the coming years play out, given the advent of technologies, interest rate environment, whether or not, you know, the IPO market thaws, or if we see a bigger emphasis on secondaries. But with that, you know, I'd love to know any key insights or words of wisdom you'd either leave to yourself if you were getting started in venture again, or founders for that matter, who are interested in working with VCs to help speed up their innovations.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the most important observations, and now has just become kind of a value set for me, is venture benefits from authenticity. Authenticity of relationships, authenticity of work and work ethic, authenticity of intent. So if I were to give advice to any emerging, you know, VC investor, any emerging fund, early career venture professionals, my advice would be hold on to authenticity and try to catalyze and support authentic tone and tenor in all of your interactions in this profession. We all benefit from it. And by the way, it's just, I mean, this is hard work. It's extremely difficult work. And so authenticity makes it much easier. The other thing I would say is, you know, the highs are high and the lows are low for founders and in a similar way for investors in this asset class. I think private equity, you know, you can say the same thing, the highs are high and the lows are low, but the amplification of the highs and the amplification of the lows is different because it's a different asset class. You've got more established companies attracting private equity than you do in venture capital. We're really, you know, much more focused on early stage innovation, and these companies, not all of them are going to hit. So we get to a point where we feel like these companies are siblings. You know, there are siblings. And we're really close to our siblings, and we want all of our siblings to do super well and to be happy and enjoy the work that they're doing. And but it doesn't hit every single time. So that if you can manage that pendulum swing between the highs and the lows, you're really much better situated to both enjoy the work that we do in venture, but also over a long career to be able to look back and say, you know, I did well. We did well, and we've been successful in supporting innovation and catalyzing growth, and just bring mission and purpose to this profession that goes just beyond, a little bit beyond, financial sponsorship objectives. Because there's so much more that we do beyond our financial capital in support of these companies. And remember that, keep that squarely in focus, because that's really important as well. We don't want to be investing in solutions that, even though they might generate amazing outcomes, aren't really moving the needle in some kind of meaningful way, right? We want to be able to walk away from this at some point in our careers and say, what we supported was really mission-oriented innovation and growth.
Yeah, you know, I agree wholeheartedly, and I think it's really valuable to point out for both founders and investors alike that if you look at some of our largest, most successful companies in this country, they all have their roots in venture.
Yeah. That's right.
Brian, before we wrap up, I'm grateful that we have this forum and would love to extend it to you to recognize anyone in your personal professional network who's had a material impact on your success.
Yeah, there are so many. I'm sure we all say that. I go back to elementary teachers, high school teachers. I think of college professors, grad school professors. I think of relationships in my personal life. I think of partners in previous funds, colleagues in my current fund. It's really hard, but I think the first time that the one individual I'll single out, although there are, I mean, many people have had favorable impact on the trajectory of my career and just growth as a person. But there was an individual who showed this unique and maybe unexplained, if I'm being very vulnerable here, confidence in me even before I saw that in myself. A guy by the name of Frank Day, who just sadly passed away a couple weeks ago. A real innovator and entrepreneur here in Colorado. And I worked for him for a number of years. And he, as I say, he saw something in me, I think, before even I saw it. And he, in some ways, in his own unique approach, opened that possibility and that potential in my own mind. And I think that's key. For every individual, there's a moment in life when you either go kicking and dragging into this acknowledgement that you've got potential and you're willing to do the work to achieve that potential. And sometimes you need somebody to just give you a little tap on the shoulder. And and he did probably a little bit of both and even more to kind of open the shades. So that I could look out the window and see what my potential was. And he also did so in a way where we didn't take ourselves so seriously that if we got bad news on a given day, that it wasn't the end of the world. That at the end of the day, we're all just trying to do good. We're trying to make something work. We're trying to make a little money while we're at it, but really just do some good work and put smiles on people's faces. And walk away with a smile on our own face. And so that's someone who I'm thinking quite a bit about just today, since he very recently passed away and made a huge mark on my life.
Well, shout out to Frank. If only all of us could be so fortunate to have someone who can give us great perspective. Because you're right, it can be challenging to be a founder and an investor.
Yeah.
There's definitely
So
not
true.
only highs but lows, and having someone help us see the forest for the trees is extremely
So
valuable.
true. So true.
Brian, I really appreciate your time. If any members
You
of
bet.
our audience, whether founders or co-investors alike, would like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
They can find me, just go to our Ensemble Innovation Ventures website. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm easy to find there. But all my contact info is on our Ensemble Innovation Ventures website. So look forward to talking with anybody about healthcare innovation.
Fantastic. Brian, thank you. Tremendous insights. Appreciate your time. And again, for the benefit of our audience, Brian Armstrong, Managing Director, Ensemble Innovation Ventures. Thank you for joining us for another episode, the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, Founder CEO of FinTrat Management. Thank you. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.